I joined the Cornell faculty in 1984. When I was hired from University of California, Davis, and did a lot. I'm an ecologist, PhD in ecology, but did a lot of work on how environmental stress affects plants and forests and soils and all of that. And I wasn't at Cornell more than a few years when I saw that first Mauna Loa trace of the carbon dioxide going up exponentially that you probably have all seen. The evidence that CO2 is rising dramatically, that was becoming very clear late in the 80s. And I recognized as what I knew about plant physiology and ecosystems that that would have a big effect because plants take up carbon dioxide for photosynthesis, et cetera. And each plant, different species would respond differently, would affect plant composition in forests. So I decided to, you know, overlap my stress experiments, like imposing drought and temperature stress on plants, with the CO2. So I became kind of a CO2 expert. And then during the Clinton administration, there was the first kind of regional assessments of impacts of climate change. And I led up the natural resources and agriculture thing for the Northeast and have been involved in numerous assessments ever since then. An interesting little, you know, well, more than an anecdote, I would say I'm like a lot of people who got into this game a while ago. When I got in, I actually never expected to see much real serious climate change in my career. I actually thought I would be laying the groundwork for the next generation of scientists in terms of the climate changing. I thought I'd be looking at the CO2 per se effects, that would happen in my lifetime, but I didn't expect the climate change to be nearly as dramatic as I've seen in my lifetime, so kind of interesting. I think there's a lot of my colleagues feel the same way. Over the years being in that, doing work in that climate change area, of course I've done a number of news media interviews, but always kind of one-on-one, and it's nice to have a bit of a round table of news media, and I'm looking forward to discussion. I've got a bunch of slides, and we'll just let the conversation go where it may as we go through the slides. On this first one, there's a few, that's my website there. We have a climate change website at Cornell, which is going to be going through some major renovations soon, but anyway, just to know about it. And I don't know if it was, I think it was indicated on maybe the flyer that went out about this, but there's a new, one of the most recent assessment I've been involved with is one focus funded by NYSERDA here in New York, and involve scientists at Columbia and Cornell, some other scientists as well, like at Rutgers. And it was to look at really getting New York prepared for what are the big impacts on different sectors of the economy, and more importantly, how can we adapt to these things? So there was one on public health and one on the energy sector, et cetera. I led two teams, one the agriculture team and the other the ecosystems team. That report is not released yet, but you can get the synthesis draft at this long-winded link, and I can give this to you, or we can put this up again at the end. It's actually a little bit, it's climateaid-synthesis, it goes off in a .pdf. So as a PDF you can get of this fairly big big report. I'll go ahead and pass this around while we're talking. So you can download that whole thing, although it's still in draft stage. The formal announcement should be coming out, we don't know. We've really done our work. It's a matter of polishing it up, and maybe in a month or two, it will be formally released. So this is, something that's since my emphasis is often on landscapes and that sort of thing, and working with people who deal with land management, this is the kind of climate data that actually sort of hits home with some of those groups. This is the plant hardiness zone map. Some of you may be familiar with this kind of thing that's at garden centers, et cetera. It's a color-coded map of the U.S., and the different colored zones indicate how cold it gets in the winter. And these have been produced by the USDA several times. The last one done by the USDA was 1990. They always go back to the 15 years prior of NOAA weather station records for the coldest it got in that area. In 2006, a new one was done by the Arbor Day Foundation, and you can see no matter where you live in the U.S., the climate zones have shifted. And it's this kind of one thing, you know, I really would like to emphasize to you is the pace of this kind of, you know, the pace of change that we're seeing. This is really unprecedented, going back hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years actually, in global history, to see, you know, the climate's always changing. I've got a slide coming up talking about that. But at this speed is really unprecedented. So while we can say historically, looking at the long-term geological records, vegetation has adapted and trees have moved, tree species have moved along with climate change, but it wasn't moving like at this pace. So we're kind of entering new territory with this. I mentioned how I didn't expect the climate to be changing so dramatically in my own career. And another thing I didn't expect was that to see so much evidence of the living world responding. And this is some data from a peer-reviewed paper of mine that I did with some colleagues where a number of ecologists around the globe actually started looking up historical records of seasonal biological events, such as first leaf out, first bloom, arrival of bird migrations, arrival of insects, that kind of thing. And when we started digging up these historical records, what we find is throughout the Northern Hemisphere, wherever you dig into those, while there are some exceptions here and there and some species that are more day length hardwired and not so sensitive to temperature, we see many species. For example, in our study, we found plants blooming earlier. And I could give you several peer-reviewed papers for other evidence in the northeastern U.S. of other phenomenon along these lines. So when I saw this, I've worked with farmers since I first came to Cornell, but I really didn't tell them about my climate change work that much. I work with them a lot with soils and soil conservation and other things. But when I saw this, I really started moving my work out talking to the farmer audience, even though they're a fairly conservative group, as you might imagine, and as you all know, a very politicized topic. But I've been communicating with them for a long time, and we have a new, I'll pass around here, you can each take a copy, a new fact sheet for farmers called Farming Success in an Uncertain Climate. So that whole thing of talking to farmers continues. So the climate's always changing. But what I really want to emphasize is seldom has the pace of change been what we're seeing today. And to put that in perspective, I always use this example. Right here where we're sitting 10 to 15,000 years ago, the glacial ice would have been about up to the sixth floor here. Our ecosystem here would have been solid ice. Over the course of that 10 to 15,000 years, the Earth warmed by about 11 degrees Fahrenheit. And look how dramatically things have changed. Now we expect within the next 100 years, we could have almost a similar magnitude of temperature increase at the business as usual greenhouse gas emissions scenario. So it's really very much, of course, dependent on what people do in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. But if you do the math on that, I mean, we're not talking about the pace of change being a little faster than we've seen between interglacial periods. We're talking about 100 times faster. So that's a lot. And that's really what kind of scares us ecologists. We just had this recent flooding, as I was mentioning to a couple people earlier before we really got started here, when you talk to climate scientists about extreme events in climate change, there's consensus about a lot of things, the general warming, more heat stress events in the summer, a few things. But they won't in general say, extreme events, there's going to be an increased frequency of those. But when it does come to flooding, we do have a lot of evidence that we're getting more of the rain in the Northern Hemisphere, including our region, more of the rain that does come, comes packaged in high rainfall events. Defined in this case as more than 2 inches in 48 hours. In general, there's more of the water on the planet is up in the air as humidity. The warmer it gets, more is evaporating from the soil and plants. There's more humidity up there. So then you get a cold air condensation event and there's more to come down. So there's that phenomenon. This is just different parts of the Northeast. The same trend, this is just showing from 1920s to 2000. Of course, a lot of variability like with all climate data, but the same in most cases, statistically significant trend of increased frequency of high rainfall events. And all the models project, we just did this new study I just mentioned that's coming out, shows when you look at, we did 16 general circulation models, 16 climate models, an ensemble, all point to this trend continuing. So the flooding we just had here is an example. I wouldn't say this about all extreme events, but I think the flooding events we just had in New York are an example where you would say at least part of that could be associated with this phenomenon and with a couple other phenomenon as well. Two other phenomenon associated with flooding. More of the rain coming in high rainfall events. The other two are when you have a seaborne storm, a tropical storm coming up the coast, sea temperatures, the warmer the sea temperature, the more energy feeds into those storms. So as we have warmer, and around the globe, including off our coast here, we generally have warmer sea temperatures. So in the past, a tropical storm that might slide up along North Carolina and towards the northeast might die out as it hits the colder waters there. But with warmer sea temperatures, they're more likely to continue. So there's that phenomenon. And then finally, the sea level, which you're all aware of, the sea level rise is a general phenomenon that we're seeing no matter where you have a meter stick in the water and been monitoring it, it's going up. In New York City, it's about 16 inches rise in the last 75 years. And again, all the models project that's going to continue. If the glaciers all melt and the Greenland slips in, of course, it could be extremely dramatic. But even without that, the majority actually of the sea level rise we've seen to date is not due to big icebergs and glaciers melting, just due to thermal expansion, just the warmer sea temperatures. The water molecules are literally more separated from each other, and that's what much of the sea level rise is about. So we've had this flooding event. We've got the governor traveling around the state, handing out, talking about flood relief, which, thank goodness, a very excellent response in the governor's getting good press, I think, for the good work he's doing and getting out to these areas and doing this disaster mitigation. But I would argue, what we also need our politicians to do is begin doing some preparation to reduce the magnitude of these kind of climate events, particularly ones where we know with a high degree of certainty are really part and parcel of climate change. So as I say here, things like dealing with our economy, with our national deficit, all of these things, it really goes hand in hand with climate change preparedness. Saying, well, we have this deficit and we shouldn't be investing in things that might prepare us for climate change, I think makes a big mistake because, unmitigated climate change, we're going to end up spending lots of tax dollars on disaster relief, humanitarian assistance, infrastructure replacement, and higher insurance costs. So what I kind of, since I have an audience of press people here, I would say when we have a weather event, and one that, based on what you're hearing from the climate scientists, is one that is quite likely, at least partly associated with climate change, to ask the politicians about their work on preparing for these kind of future events, not only going out there and giving out the disaster relief after the fact. And there's another tie between these two things, between climate change and economic development and sustainable development, and it gets a little closer to what I really work on, and that's land use planning and agriculture and forestry and that sort of thing. And that's that things we can do in terms of how we manage our lands can help mitigate climate change. So I have some examples here. Sustainable land use practices can help to reduce greenhouse gases and sequester carbon in the soils by reducing deforestation. When we cut down trees, they decay and decompose. Their carbon goes up in the air as CO2. Afforestation means replanting and planting trees. Also, things like rotating with legumes. If we have time and we get into some of the details about agriculture, I'll be explaining to you how nitrogen, actually, and the use of nitrogen fertilizers is a big part of the agricultural contribution to greenhouse gases. As nitrogen fertilizers decompose in the soil, they give off nitrous oxide, which is about 300 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. So just something in terms of what farmers do in terms of managing their nitrogen more efficiently can be important. And then when farmers till the soil, or even when the gardener is out there turning the soil over and over, this really over-oxygenates the soil, tends to speed up decomposition, and you end up with a lot of carbon in the soil going up in the air's atmosphere. So a lot we can do in terms of how we manage our land that also relates to climate change. So that link between the two is something I want to emphasize. One thing that our this study that's coming out, and actually I was involved in the Northeast climate change assessment that the Union of Concerned Scientists was involved with back in 2008. I don't know if any of you, I was led the ag team and also was involved in the ecosystem team there. Both studies have come to this conclusion, really. Our forests and our natural landscapes are really, we're already kind of the horses out of the barn, as they say, and they're going to be changing in terms of climate change. The mix of species and that sort of thing. We don't really know exactly the details of how they will change. It's hard to predict. But the important thing is, you know, in addition to those of us who just care about wanting to go back to landscapes and they're there like we're familiar with them, they also have important implications in terms of things like clean water, these ecosystem services type things, flood control, and of course, winter recreation and that kind of thing. So very important. These natural landscapes, we really, like I say, we can't predict exactly what's going to happen, but the statement on the right, I can tell you with a high degree of certainty, our natural landscapes are going to be disassembling and reassembling in new ways. Some species are not going to make it. Some are going to thrive. Some new species are going to come in. It's not that there's not going to be any vegetation out there or any plants out there or animals. There's going to be things out there, but we don't know what. And of course, we worry a lot about invasives. These would be very aggressive plants or aggressive animals that happened, if they happened to benefit and do particularly well under the new climate scenario, we could end up with a less diverse type of natural landscape. So it's not that there wouldn't be anything out there, but you know, it's all honeysuckle or something. I don't know. You know, something that we may not find desirable. So that's about all we can say. There are studies in part of the Northeast assessment, and we did some more work along this line in the new study that will be coming out shortly, has looked at what the mix, how, what it means in terms of tree species, for example. And this study was based on just, we know a lot about these trees and what climate scenario and soils they thrive in and what kind of climate envelope they do best in. And the bottom line of what we found is that, for example, in New York State, where much of our natural forests are maples, beech, and birch, gives us that beautiful fall color, those, all three of those species are going to, are the climate's going to be less suitable for them. It's going to be much more suitable for oak, hickory, and pine. So we could, now are we really going to have a replacement? Are the oak seeds really going to come up here and reestablish where we had maples? This is a complicated story, and this is why I say we can't tell you what's going to happen. With the oak example, just one, you know, example of a complication. As I'll mention in a future slide to come in a couple moments, deer are likely to be a species that's likely to benefit from warmer temperatures in New York State. They happen to like eating oak seedlings more than they like eating maple and beech and birch. So the oaks might come up here, but they're going to have a harder time establishing because there's more deer. So it's very complicated when this comes. With this particular study, just to continue, this is color-coded based on different types of forest ecosystems. Spruce fir, those of us who like to go to the Adirondacks, notice a little splotch of spruce fir. That's the only place in New York State, and a little bit in Adirondacks, which doesn't quite show up on this map. A little bit of spruce fir. Notice, even in the lower emissions scenario, by end of century, we have no spruce fir in New York State. Well, I shouldn't say that. The climate will no longer be suitable for those trees. Will they survive? Will they be haggard and somehow be surviving? Some maybe, but it won't be suitable. Down here, this is the higher emissions, kind of business as usual emission scenario. The gray is the oak hickory type forest, and you see very little of the maple, beech, birch, more like just in the Adirondacks. So I'm not saying, again, you know, that this is exactly how it's going to be, but it gives you an example of what the models are telling us. Another thing that concerns us as ecologists is that just like every human might respond differently to climate change, I mean, some of us might think it's a wonderful thing that we might have a climate like Georgia. Of course, it's not going to necessarily be exactly like that, but whatever. And some might hate it. Some of us might move. Some of us might adapt. The same thing with species. So every species is going to respond differently, uniquely. Some might change rapidly. Some might not. So, for example, with plants and pollinators, if the plants are blooming earlier, will their pollinators come out earlier to be there to pollinate them? if the pollinators happen to be hardwired to not respond to temperature but only to day length, they might not change while the plants are blooming earlier, so they wouldn't be there. Same thing, natural enemies of insect pests and all these kinds of, you know, as you know, in our natural landscapes and on our farms and even in Central Park, et cetera, you know, it's not one species out there by itself. There's all these interactions. So if everything's responding a little differently, what kind of disruption of species interactions might we have? And this is not something I can tell you with a high degree of certainty, you know, it's going to be all doom and gloom. I mean, there could be some good things, some bad things that happen, but it's something that's an active area of research. Specifically for New York, you know, this is just sort of a laundry list to give you an example of winners and losers, you might say, if you want something like that. And there's reasons for these. So likely to benefit, I mentioned white-tailed deer. First of all, just the warmer winters themselves. It can get cold enough in the winter here to sometimes kill off some young deer. More importantly, though, is that we're going to have less snow cover in the winter. We're already seeing that trend. And the snow covers up the food for the deer in the winter. So many of them starve to death or are very weak. But with less snow cover, they'll be eating better all winter, eating more vegetation, actually affecting plant communities that way too, of course, with big implications. But they're likely to be a big winner. Interesting with the fish, that's our state fish right now, the brook trout. It's a cold water fish. Its habitat's already shrinking and going to be shrinking more and more into cold water refuges of our deepest water lakes and places where we got streams and lakes where there's good shading. But their habitat will be shrinking, whereas something like bass would be benefiting because it's a warm water species. Invasive species, we have good evidence that both of these, the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is a little tiny aphid-like thing, but it wreaks havoc on hemlock trees, very important evergreen in New York. South of here, it's moving into New York, and that movement is definitely linked with climate change. It currently marginally overwinters. Same thing with kudzu. Anybody familiar with that from the south? It's a very notorious, aggressive weed. So that's likely to benefit. Some hardwood tree species, if we have longer growing seasons and we don't have really bad droughts and a lot of ifs here, but the combination of higher carbon dioxide, longer growing season could benefit some trees. But then, as I mentioned up here, things like the spruce firs, I mentioned these high elevation species will be lost. So we're already seeing this phenomenon. I mean, our winters, you know, in central New York, well, actually, it's all of upstate New York, the average winter temperatures have gone up about 4 degrees Fahrenheit since the 1970s. So we're seeing this already. And that's good for a number of pests. With insects, you've got a couple issues. So there's some that only, you know, some of them just can't survive our normal winters. They die off in the winter. Even if you own a pet dog, you know, if fleas will, we have less problem with dog fleas here, if you might notice, than if you've ever lived south of here. And that's because a lot of fleas die off in the winter. And this is called the flea beetle. It happens to be the vector. It's not so much a problem on plants per se, but it carries a disease called Stewart's wilt, which devastates cornfields. And so that's marginally overwintering insect doing better and better as the winters are getting warmer. But then also insects can have more generations per season. They can reproduce more during the season, and their ranges are expanding. So these are examples of two insects in New York that we haven't seen much problem with in the past, and we're seeing more and more problem with in the future. There's the picture of kudzu. We did a modeling study looking at the future range of kudzu, this aggressive weed. This is going from left to right. We're looking towards near term to end of century. The top panel is looking at the kind of higher emissions, business as usual scenario. The lower panel is the lower emissions. And the dark orange red is the range of kudzu. And you can see as we move towards the end of the century, New York becomes pretty much entirely kudzu land, potentially. So that's an issue. This is the hemlock woolly adelgid, and just looking at its movement up and out since its introduction and its potential for future introduction and in relation to the hemlock. And so, as I mentioned, that's a big problem for hemlocks. One thing I liked about this new study coming out, the CLIMATE, as it's called, NYSERDA-funded study, is that we did focus a lot on what can we do about it. And with natural ecosystems, though, it's more challenging than, for example, when I talk about agriculture, because those are so heavily managed, it's easier to think about solutions. But a few things, of course, is simply thinking about, there's a lot of things stressing our natural ecosystems and our landscapes now, and trying to reduce those stressors, having rapid response plans for invasives as they come in, for example, these kinds of things can help us. We've made some progress on acid rain problems in the Adirondacks, and that's a good thing because that will make them more resistant to climate change problems. So that's one strategy. Something else, and we've actually talked a lot to the NGOs like the Nature Conservancy and other people who work a lot on preservation of our natural landscapes. Even they agree, that it doesn't make sense to think we're going to, in the face of the climate change that's coming down the pike, maintain the exact same mix of species that we have today in our natural landscapes. That just does not make sense. To battle and battle and battle, it's going to be fighting a losing battle. Now, we may want to maintain some small pockets of native species so they can be seed sources and that sort of thing for restoration of areas. But really, we have to do more focus on what is the ecosystem, sort of what's its function, making sure we maintain some diversity. We don't allow just one invasive to come in and dominate. But we probably can't battling for, exactly the same species, because we actually may want to facilitate some species that are south of here to move in and fill a niche that some species that can no longer survive. A pollinator is no longer can survive in a particular area, but maybe a substitute pollinator can come in, for example. So in terms of that gets into the next one. We want to facilitate this this movement of species as these non-human species themselves are struggling with dealing with the problem we've helped create. They're going to be trying to move around and find the best place for themselves. And of course, we've got a lot of this so-called habitat fragmentation. By that, I mean with urban sprawl and all of that, it's hard for species to move from one area to another because there's a freeway there or there's a huge, large urban area in the way. So the less we can, the more we can avoid that habitat fragmentation. One strategy, riparian zones, refers to the zones along stream banks, really, is the simplest way to put this. And so these are things where humans tend to keep hands off anyway. And broadening those stream bank zones, those could be nice corridors for species to move up. So protecting our riparian zones is an important strategy for helping natural ecosystems adapt. And then finally, there's a lot of NGOs. There's universities like Cornell. There's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, all these organizations working on these things. We're actually having a meeting at Cornell on December 5th where we're going to go into some detail on the ecosystem component of this report. And we'll be focusing a lot of our attention with all these agencies. How do we basically coordinate our efforts? And how do we have monitoring programs so we can all keep track of what species are moving where and where the invasive and all of that sort of thing. So now I'm going to kind of move on to farmers and gardeners, but does anybody want to, we can come back to the ecosystems, but anybody have any kind of comments or questions about what I've been saying so far?
Sure. Have you seen, in terms of the realization that it's going to be, you will not be able to maintain the sort of what we think of as the native mix of species now in the future, is that being, from your sense, that being felt sort of at the fish and wildlife kind of area? Obviously, a lot of what these groups, organizations, agencies do is to try to just do that to defend against invasives. Is there a sense that you're feeling that they're realizing that might not be possible, and so we need to really reconsider?
Yeah, we had, for example, for this this new study, we had an expert panel that included us leadership from a number of government agencies and a number of the NGOs, including one of the NGOs that really works on heritage species and conservation of those. And I think the phrase from one of the, I think it was the guy from Nature Conservancy, says, you know, we're not trying to build dioramas out here. You know, that's not what we can't really do that. We can't expect to do that. But it's going to be tricky because, as I say, I still think we want to maintain diversity. I think that's probably the key, maintaining a biologically diverse community. And that could take some battling because there could be some invasives that are really, as I say, happen to do better under the new climate scenario, and they're so aggressive that they just take over. So I think there's pretty broad support for that notion. So for gardeners and farmers, you know, when I talk to this audience about climate change, you know, sometimes the eyes open wide and a big smile, and it's like, wow, it's going to be warmer, longer growing season. I can grow those camellias that my cousin Millie grows south of here, or I'm a farmer and now I can finally have a good enough season to grow watermelons or this kind of stuff. And actually at Cornell, being a land grant, you know, we're all about, and I think there's some real opportunities here. I give talks around the world and around the U.S. on this, and when I go even to the western U.S., it's not always such a pretty picture for agriculture. There's no, you know, very little benefit in some areas because it's already as hot as you can possibly get it and grow crops, and being a little warmer is not going to do you any good. Whereas here we do have this possibility of taking advantage of some new markets, some new opportunities, and so we're all about that at Cornell. The tricky thing for farmers is, as you might imagine when you think about the reality of it, it's not cheap for a farmer to change a quote crop they grow. It often's different kinds of equipment. They have to develop new market channels. It's a big investment of their time. Will the markets even be there? What's happening with their neighbors and their competition? So it's a risk to change crops. Of course, obviously, the most obvious example would be perennial crops. Am I going to take out my apple orchard and put in peaches? Well, that's a multi-million dollar decision for some farmers. And even though it might be, at some point, a wise decision, the question is, at what point is it wise to do that? So one thing we're doing at Cornell, for example, is we're developing these web-based decision tools for farmers where they can look at climate scenarios for where they live and kind of play out some decisions. So they can come up with, when's the strategic time for me to make a change? Maybe I should wait 5 years. And, you know, a certain climate phenomenon might not be, weather phenomenon might not be part and parcel of climate change. It might just be a fluke. So it's tricky for farmers to know how to make those changes. But anyway, we're all about helping them find those new opportunities. But some things may disappear. I mean, there's some crops we grow today which may never, we may be seeing the peak of their production in New York. I don't know if many of you know, but we're usually number one in the U.S. in cabbage production in New York. That might not be the case 30, 40 years ago, because that's 30, 40 years down the road, because that's a very cool season crop. Potatoes, apples, a few other crops are crops that I wouldn't say we can't grow them in the future, but they'll be more challenging to grow. So, but the big thing for agriculture is I already mentioned the diseases and insects changing their range, so a lot more weed and disease and insect pressure. And then new challenges for water. The flooding thing, big problem for farmers too. Not only waterlogged, killing off crops, but this recent flooding, when stream banks overflow, even if the crop survives that, there's a lot of email flying around among my colleagues right now throughout the Northeast. A lot of farmers, they were sort of happy. Their crops got flooded, but then it drained away, and they're going, great, my crop's still there. They can't sell it. Food and safety, it's illegal to sell it because there could be contamination from land where there was animals, grazing animals on it. So flooded land that's been flooded by stream bank overflow and that sort of thing isn't saleable. But in addition, we actually got an interesting phenomenon here in terms of the water story for New York, where we've got this problem with flooding for farmers as well as for New York City and et cetera. But despite that, we also have a projection of more summer droughts. And the way that happens is when you look at the long-term forecast for our region, the models indicate that we're likely to have maybe a slight increase in winter precipitation, probably in the form of wet rain, cold wet rain. But the summers have probably stayed about the same or even declined slightly. That's actually, you know, compared to what they're projecting for California, for example, that's not bad news. I mean, we're going to be relatively water rich, you might say, from that standpoint. But if the summer rainfall stays, let's say, exactly the same, but the summer temperatures are warmer and the crops are in the ground for longer, they will need more water. So with warmer temperatures, you've got more crop water use, and so you'll need more water. So if rainfall doesn't increase in conjunction with the increased demand for water, we're going to have more summer droughts. And all the modeling we've done indicates indeed that, more short-term summer droughts. So farmers will need irrigation and drainage equipment more than they do today. Okay, here's a little interesting story. I like to present this as kind of how complicated it is to predict anything, even in agriculture. I talked about the ecosystems being hard to predict. So one thing we've said, European wine grapes, unlike the Concords, which are adapted to New York, those Concords can withstand very cold winter temperatures. But European wine grapes, if it gets below about minus 12 Fahrenheit in the winter, they're not native to here, so they'll be really badly damaged. And up in the Finger Lakes region, of course, historically, that's not unusual. By coincidence, since the 70s, when some entrepreneurs, for nothing to do with climate change, but just market opportunities and being a little gutsy, started growing these European wine grapes, we've had fewer and fewer winters where temperatures dip below those temperatures. So it's been very good for the Finger Lakes wine industry. And I would say, you know, this is an example of an industry that could benefit from climate change. However, this is what we found. We've actually found in 2003, 2004, in the following year, and farmers are very concerned about this, the vineyard owners as well as apple growers, we're seeing more freeze damage recently. And this is even in the midst of, even in winters where, when we look at the average winter temperatures, which is where we take December plus January plus February, look at the average temperature over that winter period, it was a warmer winter in these years. But what it was is, that was dominated by a warm December. And what happens when you have a really warm December followed by a, quote, normal January is the plants don't harden up to cold temperatures. They don't go through this physiological phenomenon of hardening properly, or they actually de-harden. So then when normal January temperatures come, their threshold for damage is much higher, and they're much more susceptible to damage. So I do think this is, to end this story, I still think in the long term, this is an example of an industry, particularly like European red wine grapes, the Merlots and Cabernets and that, an industry which is likely to benefit in the long term. But there's this transition period we're going through right now, which is complicated. Longer growing seasons, warmer summers, I said opens up market opportunities, but it undoubtedly will lead to more summer days with heat stress. And I mean, for human beings living in New York City, the public health section of this report that's coming out is filled with information about summer heat stress and impacts on particularly vulnerable populations and all of that, and allergens and all kinds of other things. But it also means, of course, summer heat stress for certain crops. And New York State dairy really dominates our ag economy, close to $2 billion a year, very big dairy state. Turns out dairy cows like it really cool. Maximum milk production is between 40 and 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Just get into the 80s, upper 80s, and milk production goes down. And so we don't have time to go into details, but we've done some modeling studies on this because we know pretty well how milk production responds to temperature. And without adaptation, assuming the farmers don't do anything to improve the cooling capacity of their dairy barns, we will have reduced milk production, which is tough on the very fragile dairy industry. Simple solution, so often is the case with agriculture, the solution's sort of straightforward, but it's not cost or risk free. Put in more vents and more cooling fans, more sprinklers, air conditioners if you have to. Talk to a dairy farmer about retrofitting their dairy barn with air conditioners and they'll just laugh their socks off. They would go out of business way before they would do that. They just can't possibly come up with that kind of thing. But it is something where, you know, if you're a dairy farmer and it's about time to put up a new dairy barn, don't build it with the heat specs of the 20th century. You want to build it with the cooling capacity you need for the 21st century. And this actually goes for, you know, city infrastructure and everything. As we go through these routine infrastructure replacements, it could be a sewage or runoff replacement system, wastewater system for a city, you don't want to be using the 20th century information. So certainly something to keep in mind. As I mentioned, so the tricky thing is, you know, not so much that we don't have no idea what the solutions would be for agriculture or other land managers. We know what we could do about some of these things, but some of them are expensive. And then even if it's not that expensive, it's like, when exactly do you make that change? And it's tricky. So, and this is where we're really just going to have to give farmers new tools, including some economic analyses, and then really the business owner has to make their own decision, I think, on what they want to do, what their risk, you know, what their risk aversion is, et cetera. So agriculture adaptation, a lot of things to do. Many of these are on the farm. Simple things, adjusting the planting dates. You can start planting earlier. Already in New York State, we have corn growers who are experimenting with longer growing season corn varieties because those can yield a little more. They got burned this last year. We had a longer growing, this year I mean, they're going to get burned. We had a longer growing season based on the frost dates, but they couldn't get in the ground because it was so wet in April. So it's tricky there too. But anyway, there's things farmers can do. Of course, new strategies for the pests, new diseases and weeds that come up, irrigation and drainage, et cetera. And then there's things that you know, governments and universities can do in terms of information systems and monitoring of new pests, et cetera. A lot of things that agencies can do. And I don't want to take more time right now to get into that. We do worry about equity issues, and this comes in, of course, to all kinds of aspects of climate change. You've probably heard about this issue in terms of developed countries versus developing countries, you know, being more capable. So when we talk about, you know, instead of just is it real or not, focusing where I think we should focus and where I would encourage the press to focus is, you know, what do we do about it? We run up against this problem. We may know what to do about it, but not everybody has the same capacity to do that thing we know to do. They might not have the money. They might not have the access. They might have a cultural problem with accepting climate change, a political problem with it, and putting their head in the sand and not making adaptations when they should. A lot of our dairy farms, for example, they're living pretty much, you know, close to the edge economically, and even though it might be a simple investment to add a few cooling vents, it could be the difference between them deciding to get out of the business or not, and that kind of thing. So we worry a lot about that. And at Cornell, of course, we have a whole small farms program, and we try to address that. The last thing I wanted to get into is just a few slides on, you know, what I talked about so far is, and what the NYSERDA report is all focused on adaptation. That is kind of coping with the inevitable. You know, dealing with it, taking advantage of opportunities, dealing with some negative things. But then there's this other thing, which is, you know, becoming part of the solution, actually reducing greenhouse gas emissions and all of that. And I just have a new USDA grant, $4.7 million grant, that's focused on, and we've got another fact sheet coming out on this too, which isn't ready quite for prime time yet, so I don't have it for you today. But it's all about managing energy, greenhouse gases, and carbon on the farm. And it's all profit-driven, really not, doesn't even call on the farmer to be just being the good citizen. But there's a lot of reasons why farmers might, with, you know, obvious increases in energy costs going up, energy swings, our dependence on foreign oil, and farmer uncertainty about future energy policies. I mean, that alone, even if you don't, quote, believe in climate change, are reasons to be concerned about these things. A lot of farmers are getting into renewable energy on the farm, supporting some of their, you know, energy costs or getting onto the grid. There's a lot of, you know, issues with farmers getting into renewable energy sources and having trouble. There's a lot of rules and regulations about them being able to sell that electricity. And some of you may be even more familiar with that than me, but it's something I think the press could push our policymakers on is trying to make it more, you know, facilitate this sort of movement, which is farmers interested in renewable energy on the farm. And believe it or not, there's actually like some, a lot of stumbling blocks that have to do with government policy. I wanted to point out, when it comes to agriculture emissions on the farm, there's three greenhouse gases. Do you guys know the three main greenhouse gases associated with climate change? There's carbon dioxide, of course, is one. Methane?
Nitrous oxide.
Nitrous oxide, okay. And this is how it divides up for agriculture, but I haven't told you which is which. So one of them is 44% of agriculture emissions, 36% and 20%. So carbon dioxide would be associated with things like tractor driving, tillage of the soil, turning up, decomposing carbon and all that. Here's how it breaks down. That's the smallest piece. On most farm analyses of their kind of carbon calculator, which we're developing these web-based carbon calculators for farms, nitrous oxides are the big culprit. Most of this, about 70%, as I mentioned, of total U.S. nitrous oxide emissions are associated with agriculture. Now, this is it's a small component of the global warming potential of nitrous oxide. It's in very tiny trace amounts in the atmosphere compared to CO2. And overall, carbon dioxide at a national scale or international scale, global scale, carbon dioxide is the big player, accounting for well over 60% of global warming. But when you talk about agriculture per se, this is where agriculture can play. It's a low-hanging fruit for agriculture anyway. It's reducing nitrous oxide emissions. And this has to do with nitrogen fertilizer use. And some of this probably can't be avoided because we need more food for more people. Farmers are going to be using nitrogen fertilizers. But it can be done sloppily or it can be done very efficiently. And so we're a lot of work at Cornell and other places moving farmers towards more efficient nitrogen management, not only for what you've probably heard before, some of you at least, the water quality issues with nitrogen fertilizers, nitrates getting into the water. That's nitrates, NO3. This is a gas, nitrous oxide. So that's a big issue. Methane is associated with, of course, the cows, their bacteria in their guts, but also manure degradation, et cetera, gives off methane. And rice paddies give off methane, et cetera. So here's sort of a laundry list of things we can do on the farm. All of these, I would say, are win-win sort of situations for farmers. We can improve farmer profits. But I want to mention just again a little bit more about this nitrogen fertilizer piece and manure management, that one right there. So these synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, first of all, are energy intensive to produce. About 4 to 6 tons of carbon are emitted per ton of nitrogen manufactured in a synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. So even as a home gardener or lawn owner, when you go buy your synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, you've kind of increased your carbon footprint. And then there's this issue I just mentioned. All nitrogen fertilizers give off nitrous oxides, even manures, et cetera, as they degrade in soil. So improving nitrogen management efficiency is a big thing. One thing is getting growers to go back to rotating with legume crops, which are it's a crop that produces, basically gives the farmer free nitrogen because it produces nitrogen in its roots with a symbiosis with bacteria, and is a good way to do that. And there's various other approaches we have. The homeowner doesn't get off. There's over 3 million acres of lawn in New York State alone. There's more lawn in the U.S. than there is irrigated acreage of any single crop. And a lot of lawns, their nitrogen's managed poorly. And if you do the carbon budget on a lot of homes, especially those with big lawns, and if they're the type that want to be the first in their neighborhood with the green lawn and put on a lot of nitrogen fertilizer, that's a big part of their budget. That's a cow pie, in case you didn't recognize it. I teach a class called Cropping Systems Ecology, kind of ecological principles to ag production. And the challenge to this young scientists I have in those classes is I talk about how in the past century we really sort of decoupled animal and crop production systems. And there's really economic reasons why we can't go back entirely, good economic reasons why that happened. But we need to think about how we can recouple them as much as possible, because things like what's waste to one person is a source of nitrogen, carbon, energy, and other things to others. Anaerobic digesters are a great, another great place where, really another low-hanging fruit in agriculture, in addition to the nitrogen fertilizer management. This is a way for farmers to get energy out of the manure, can really spew out a heck of a lot of energy, can really supply much of the energy needs of a farm and beyond. The problem is right now, due to kind of a supply-demand issue, these are very expensive, and the only farmers who tend to be getting these are those who are smart enough to write grant proposals and get grants and all that. But we really could do with a lot more incentives for that, low-cost loans. And another area where I think we could really push policymakers to do more there, because farmers are all about this. They love this. But right now, they can't afford it. And biomass fuels, I'm not going to get into that, complicated story, but there are a lot of options out there. In general, I would say these are a good thing, because even as you burn them, of course, the CO2 goes right back up into the atmosphere, but they're not taking carbon from deep beneath the earth like oil. So unless you're, in order to produce the biofuels, you're using a lot of fossil fuel products like synthetic nitrogen fertilizers and a lot of tractor driving, then it can become a wash. But if you grow these with a kind of a low input system in particular, a very good part of the portfolio I think we need to have. So finally, I think for all groups, this applies to basically everybody, anybody who's in a decision maker, have to kind of realize that, we really can't, unlike all the generations before us, we really can't look at the historical climate data for where we live and say that's how we're going to make our decisions in the future. We're really the first generation of humans to face this phenomenon. If you go back the 20, 30,000 years of human history, all of those generations before us could assume that the climate was going to be roughly the same as their parents and grandparents. We can't assume that. So I think we really have to develop new approaches in the case of focusing on what I've been focusing on, environmental monitoring, pest movements, how landscapes are changing. And this second one kind of applies to not just land managers, but city managers, policymakers as well. We really need new, decision tools to decide how to adapt. Because a lot of times, as I have said a few times now, it's not that we don't have some ideas of what we might do. We have some things almost off the shelf we can do, but we don't know when to do them or how much of that to invest in. So we need some better decision tools there. And then, of course, we need all sectors to kind of be looking at ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and in a way that doesn't wipe out the profitability of various sectors of the economy, of course, but doing that. I just had the last 2 days, we had at Cornell, we had a group of Indonesian dignitaries. They got a new climate change program there from the president on down. They're all about climate change in Indonesia, partly because some of their islands are going to go underwater and they'll have to move huge populations. But they're also concerned about agriculture and other things. And that slide I showed earlier about the economic development and climate change preparedness being linked, I mean, they really get it. I mean, Indonesia kind of sees themselves as being right next. They're right up behind China and India. They see themselves as next into moving into that high economic plateau area. And they see the way to get there is to be smarter about climate change than China and India. And so they're really all about climate change preparedness. So I think that's it for my slideshow. I'll take some questions from you guys. Yeah.
Do you think that there might eventually be no live-in zones, for instance, in areas that are constantly prone to flooding or areas that are otherwise vulnerable? And yeah. Not a matter of people just saying, I can't take this anymore, I'm leaving, but actually not permitting human habitation there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's, I might have my own personal opinions, but I think that's something that that should be a legitimate policy debate and we should be thinking about, because there is, to continue rebuilding in floodplains, which are just, and that's always been questionable, but as the new report that's coming out will clearly show, there's some data in there in the climate section, which clearly shows that, and also when there's a coastal zones chapter in there, will clearly show that what was the 1 in 100 year flood is now going to be the 1 in 25 year flood. I mean, the frequency of these heavy flood events is going to be increasing. So there's all the more reason to think about that as a policy option. It could be that just markets, you know, people can't get insurance in a lot of places now, and so that could drive people out too. So, but I think that that's a very legitimate thing to discuss. So I think dealing with those, you know, getting at those questions is a really great place for the press to dig into. You know, I think covering the climate change in the past has really been about, you know, here's the scientists who say it's going to happen, here's somebody who says it's not. And I really, my opinion is those days, if you look at those days really have to be behind us, because there's so few. I don't know where you can hunt up, you know, too many scientists to keep saying that. So I really think, but you need, you know, an interesting story. And I think it's these, what do we do about it? And there's legitimate, you know, very legitimate debates about, I think there's very legitimate, you know, people could have a legitimate debate that let's just take our blows as they come. And let's hear it out, and let's have those two sides on, you know, on the news or in your papers, and let's talk about it. But what I don't like to see is climate change is not real. There's no evidence. You know, this scares me, because this gets into like, well, the problem we've got with the studying evolution in schools and all of that. It just gets into to me, the science is like, you know, there's details of the climate change that, of course, are still being studied and all that. But you know, with sea levels rising all around the world, sea temperatures up, air temperatures up, and it's overwhelming evidence, I think. So I hope you guys move towards that kind of debate. I'll encourage you to do that anyway.
Yeah. If the governor were to come to you and say, what should our priorities be when it comes to preparing for these changes and challenges from a state level? I mean, obviously,
yeah,
looking beyond just, you know, greenhouse gas emissions reductions, just preparing New York State.
Yeah.
So it's, I guess, as adaptable and as resilient as it would be,
yeah,
what would you tell him?
Well, I think, you know, certainly, and Mayor Bloomberg's, you know, right on top of this. I think New York City is a big core area to focus on. Such an important, you can't overstate the importance of New York City as an urban, national, international hub, and it's a pretty jeopardized area in terms of the flooding issues. So Mayor Bloomberg's been all on top. He's been really, in terms of preparedness, there's an example of a politician who's really all about that. You know, Governor Patterson, before Cuomo, I was on his Climate Action Council. I don't know if any of you are aware of that, but there was a whole, and Cuomo's yet to kind of move into that. I think he's just, you know, dealing with economic crises, et cetera. But I would encourage him to look at that and start following up on that, I guess, because there's already a lot of work done on a kind of a climate action plan for New York. So certainly the flooding issues in our urban centers is a big one. I think, you know, taking advantage of opportunities and really looking at it as an economic growth, a component of economic growth, because there's some potential for, maintaining or even expanding some of our utilization of land resources in positive ways. There's ways to adapt and bring in green energy, companies and that sort of thing. So I think there can be a very positive spin put on the, you know, New York's climate change readiness being part of New York's economic plan. So I would really push it that way. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think rather than, you know, to think carefully about more and more of this disaster relief money having to go out the door, and how do we, you know, get these regions prepared instead. I mean, Upper Susquehanna, we were lucky, in terms of actually humans being directly negatively affected in terms of human deaths, et cetera, was minor. And part of that goes to some planning in the past, but we need even better planning, so. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think there's a future of economic opportunity in this entire field? I mean, there's so many things that need to be done, and there need to be educated people who are capable of doing them, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that somewhere, as you were mentioning, there is an economic engine to come.
Yeah.
It's not really here yet.
Yeah, no, I really think so. I think it could be as big as the the whole Silicon Valley thing and the computer technology that took off, you know, decades ago, I think, you know, green technology industries, and you get, you know, a certain critical mass of that going here, and then you bring more and more of those industries our way. And part of it can also be, you know, setting policies. I mean, you see this happening in California, where they've set some tough standards to be followed, and then that brings green energy, green technology companies there to help meet the local, help the local population meet the high standards for emission reductions and that kind of thing. So I think setting some, you know, tough policies can actually grow the economy, although you would get some industries that might be affected in terms of having to do things differently, complaining about, you know, new things they have to do. In the long run, for the state as a whole, it could be very good for the economy. And then for something like the ag sector, I think keeping, there's no reason to think why agriculture in New York State couldn't be maintained or even grow some and in a very healthy way. So I think preparedness is a big...
Thanks, everybody. I'd say we've gone about an hour. And we've gone about an hour. There's some time for one-on-one afterwards.
Keep,
so feel free to just go ahead and come
Okay.